Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to the world of street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world. This week's interview comes from the Butterfly Mini Disc Archives and features Lee Ross. From his beginnings on the streets of New York, to an hour and a half long monster show in Brisbane, Australia, to staring down a guy who really wanted to beat the crap out of him in Boston, Lee Ross's blend of physical, verbal, and projected comedy made him one of the loudest and funniest mimes on the planet. If you have any suggestions about other performers you'd like to hear from, or other memories you'd like to share, please post them to the comment section of this podcast at buskerhalloffame.com. And now, here's Robert.
Matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plants well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Nor the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
What's your name?
So you got Lee here, Lee Ross.
And what was the name of your act? You never had a name.
Lee Ross.
Yeah, that's it. Describe the moment you decided to become a busker.
Ooh. Well, first I hate that word, busker.
Mm-hmm. Let me read them all to you. Name your favorite legendary street performers. What made these people legends? When and where did you have your greatest show? What made it so good? What's your favorite busker story? Something that happened on stage, something that happened off stage. What, if any, training have you had? What do you bring to the circle that no one else brings? Of what ad-lib line moment are you most proud? Where do you look for inspiration? And how can you help or hinder emerging artists?
Oh, boy. That's a... Some of them are easy and quick, and some of them are a little longer. So I didn't decide to become a street performer. It was more like I didn't have a choice. Didn't feel like I had a choice, because I started as a mime when I was 11. So I taught myself to juggle when I was 9. So by the time I saw my first mime, it wasn't about street performing then. It was about being a comic book hero or something. So having superpowers... Continuing in the dream world of children's imagination, going from childhood into youth and having some kind of
powers,
I guess. There wasn't even a thought around street theater. I was working on a scene in high school that had to do with, like, it was a Beckett scene or some kind of avant-garde Waiting for Godot kind of thing, and we had soft white face on. And I had already been performing and taking classes. And David Ramsey and I were in high school together. And he was street performing before I was by about 2 years. So, you know, there we were at lunch hour. And he was like, he dared me. He was like, yo, man, go ahead. Go fuck around with everybody on 6th Avenue. I dare you. I was like, all right. That's how it began. I went out on the street during lunch hour in keeping my white face on from the scene study, because in high school, the performing arts, you did scene study and acting in the morning, and you did regular biology, chemistry, math, English in the afternoon. So I would spend a lunch hour every day fucking around with people, and that led to Central Park on weekends. And the zoo, before it was renovated. So there was no one moment. But the most defining moment in my youth with street theater was going up against and being destroyed by Paul Dionne, the king of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, mime in front of the Met. I showed up at the Met after several days in the park. I was like, I'll do it. I'll go for it. And I remember suddenly hearing all this applause for someone other than me. And I look over on the other side of the steps. You know, the steps are just so huge. And there was Paul Dionne just starting a show. And it was him, Susie Neer, John Kassir, who won Star Search and has some kind of strange acting career. He just played Curly in the telemovie of the Three Stooges, the biopic.
He played that? You know, he was cast in that before?
Yeah, yeah. He came over to Australia to shoot it.
No, he was cast before anybody else was.
He did.
He was the only one they weren't looking for.
Right.
And there's a guy here in this town that is Curly.
Well, that's probably the problem. So that's kind of how, you know, there was no moment I decided to become a busker. It was just, you know, definitely a process of being seen and heard.
Well, tell me about the him. Why did that destroy you? Why would somebody else?
Oh, I was just not prepared yet to work the Met, you know. I didn't have an act. It was like my first weekend out. You know?
You said you'd worked the square before, you worked Central Park.
We're talking about over a period of 5-6 years in New York. You know, when I first started, I was 15.
Oh, and you took on the Met too soon, too early.
I remember going by there with my friend who accompanied me for the weekend. It was like my first major weekend out. And we stopped at the Met, and I was like, I'll give it a go. But suddenly, Dionne was on the other side in the regular spot. I was working the alternative spot because I didn't know. And then that whole year, that whole summer and the following, first two seasons were at the Zoo with Carl and this little group of like really mediocre performers. The guys who couldn't really work big shows. These were all the $20 hack guys.
Okay, but what happened on that steps there? What do you remember?
I just remember looking over and there was Paul Dionne, another white face. It was like, you know, the guy my dad used to take me to watch. And suddenly he looked at me and then he just looked at me for a second, but he knew. Oh, this guy doesn't, you know, kid doesn't even know what he's doing, you know. And then I just kind of like went, oh, Paul's over there, put my stuff away, kind of thought, oh, I'll go back to the park. Oh, that was good. I mean, I met Paul, too bad, because Paul was such a talented performer, and he always wanted to just be an actor. I just want to make it as an actor. And he was such a talented mime. And it's a curse. It's a curse. I get that as well. You're such an amazing mime. You're so amazing as a mime. And I'm like, no, but that's not. Name your favorite legendary street performers. What made these people? There's only, you know, come on. You know, legendary street performers are the ones who are dead. And, you know, so. Charlie Barnett's on mine too. Is on my list of, you know, even though there are some others, of course, who are still alive and, you know, everybody has their generation that influenced them. Yeah. But Charlie Barnett was, you know, undoubtedly the legendary guy for the New York.
Oh, no question about
for New York.
Really want to look for is Charlie Barnett stories, anything that you, any...
Well, I mean, I have my particular Charlie Barnett. You know, I have two that are really good. One was the season that I showed up to work the Fountain with everybody else, the Calypsos, all of us.
Now, the Calypsos were already there then. Because that was
there.
Late in Charlie's career.
But the year that I showed up to work for the season and share the pitch... there was this one day where I showed up and I was next in order and Charlie wasn't there. And I just remember I was putting my stuff out, getting ready to do the show. And I remember Charlie rocked up and the whole crowd just walked around. And you see, you know, and suddenly the whole crowd was starting to go, Charlie, Charlie. And I got up and I was like, I looked him right in the eye. I went up to Charlie and I looked at him and I was like, I'm next, motherfucker. You know, and he was like, yo, that's cool. I just got here. It was all right. You know, he was just like, yeah, let's wear it. You know, and he was hot. You know, he would come and just go do a show to get enough money to go get some crack and go
get
high.
Yeah, it was.
But I remember having to get up on the middle of the, you know, the whole crowd, Charlie. And I remember screaming, shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. I'm screaming at 400 people. Shut the fuck. And they all... Shut! They all
come a long way.
Yeah. They all
Paul Dionne.
Yeah, from Paul Dionne to that.
Can you imagine?
And I said, and then they all shut the fuck up. And I said, the white boy's next. The honky show is next. And they all kind of went. And then I went, and I did a joke or something. I did something, and then I. And that was it. You know, they were like, oh, the white boys, good. You know, and they sat back and I did that show, did a good hat. I just remember like having a good defeat to Charlie. And then later on in Vegas, another point, I went to visit John Park in Vegas when him and Scotty were doing one of the rooms there for a short one weekend. And I went to Vegas and I bumped into Charlie and he was like, let's go to this one club. And I was like, oh, no, Charlie, man. And this is when he was working for Bud Friedman. So I go up and he goes, let's get some money from Bud. And Charlie goes, yo, spot me 100, man. You know you owe me the money. And there's Bud Friedman, and I'm like, and he's like, yeah, this is my homeboy from New York. What's your name? You know, he's like, Charlie's so fucked up. Dude, fucking how many times have I had to fucking, you know. So we get in a taxi and we end up at some club that's like the honky tonk chicken chow circus club, you know, and he's got the fattest, ugliest woman that he's gyrating to. And I'm like, oh man, he's like, yo, I'm gonna get high in the back. And I remember that was just a wild night. I was like, yo man, I'm going. Yeah. He's like, yeah. He met my girlfriend once, you know, back when they were having some street performer competition at the very beginning of like, comes up to her, Marie Pierre, my French girlfriend, he goes, is your girl? I'm like, yeah. Damn, you're pretty. And then he goes, you like black dick? That was his first line to Marie Pierre. Where and when did you have your greatest show? What made it so good? That was his opening line. Where and when? She answered him seriously. She's like, I've never had black dick. Where and when did you have your greatest show? What made it so good? That's impossible to answer because I don't believe in a where and when did you have it. You know, that there isn't one greatest show. There is a zone. And when you enter that zone and you can be in that zone on a consistent basis, then you're always in the greatest show because that zone is just timeless. That zone is where the lines blur between the 1 second could equal 1 hour. You don't have a sense of time.
Not so much interested in the theory or the philosophy behind the timeless zone. Yeah, I'm looking for is...
Well, in answering that...
I mean, if I were to answer something like that, I could like give you five or six instances that...
Yeah, five or six. There are five or six that I would go. These are the... You know, the first one of the great ones was the first time that the first major show at Halifax where we opened the Hilton lawn. And I said, William, you're coming over here and we're going to open the lawn. And that gigantic...
No, I remember that place. I was there that year with you. As a matter of fact, you copped out for a while or got sick. You got a cold that year.
Maybe I did.
William had to go work Dartmouth alone one night.
Oh, that's right. That's true. I didn't. I was sick or whatever.
There was a girl.
But it was
involved.
The year of maybe it was that year. I just remember that one. I mean, one of my favorite shows was in Brisbane, and it was one night where I was all alone in the center spot where the Brisbane
Expo?
Mall. No, it was after Expo. Oh, okay. Expo was done, and I was living in Brisbane.
All right, I remember that house.
I did an hour and a half. I did most of my stand-up set, as well as a ton of verbal following, physical following, and the whole act. I went for an hour and a half. No one left, ever. I mean, it started small, and I built it and built it and built it and built it. But, I mean, no one could move. There was just, five rows seated. It was just like, if you were walking the mall on this, like, regular average, it must have been like a Friday or Saturday night, but every single person gave. And not only did every single, I filled the first hat, and I was just like, oh, I better get the second hat. But this is like filled to where you're like, there's no more room. I took out the second hat. And it was like it was like one of these miracle, it was like raining money. I just could not believe. It was one of those shows that you just went, you know, it's like the relativeness of in different countries, you know, the biggest hat you can get in Australia has a, there's a kind of cap to it, you know. They just don't give the same way in some ways as Canadian, like, you know, when you hear about, and I've always been like, there are two categories to the great, the kind of greatest show for me. I'm on the ground. Anybody who's on the ground to me is a different kind of, when you have Rick up on a 12 footer or, you know, you're like, well, you know, there are obvious advantages to having that. But I remember that night, the second hat filled up as big as the first hat to the brim. And I remember taking that home going, you know, regardless of what the hat was, it was just the most extraordinary hour and a half, because I just remember just it was Brisbane. I loved Brisbane. I was running a comedy club. It was one of those great shows for the time. There have been other, you know, there are others. My favorite is Busker Story. There are too many. There's like my favorite, what, something that happened on stage. Oh yeah, trying to tell that Edmonton the dinner party shit story when I was drunk. There you go. That moment you introduced me and you went, Lee Ross, there I am closing out the evening. Was I last? I think I was last. I can't remember. I have a terrible memory. I thought I was last that night. I remember Dick Finkel kind of going, looking at me like, Lee, we're counting on you. Like, he really was. He was like, you know, Lee, we put you last, I think, that night. And I remember going, and right as soon as I started, you know, there's that moment where you can't turn back. You've committed to the routine. You can't go, oh, I'm not going to tell it now. I had had just one too many drinks that night. I was definitely fucked up. And I remember suddenly looking at the entire crowd thinking, I am going down in flames. But I had committed to it, and I thought, you know, so be it. I'm going to tell this as best I can. Because that had killed in New Zealand and Australia. That routine, that five-minute dinner party shit story has killed. I have it on tape killing. And there I was at the opening night, fundraiser or whatever, sponsor night for Edmonton, and it was just like death. It was pure death. The only one that's worse than that is when all
tell
of the lesbian...
It.
What? There's not much more to tell. I was drunk, you know? I was trying to tell the story.
I remember doing something with that, though.
Oh, you came back on stage just going, the incomparable Mr. Lee Ross. Thank you, Lee. Getting back to the show, I remember something. It was just... Oh man, nothing's worse than being, oh man, the worst one ever was New Zealand though. Wellington Arts Festival, they had asked me to compare the final group show for the Fringe. So it was the Fringe group show.
Alice Caper Starr was still in charge, or
it was Johnny Leach.
Johnny Leach.
That little man. And I remember suddenly this woman gets up out of the 500 plus crowd and goes, you sexist pig, why can't you just do something original and stop mentioning your dick all the time? You know, something just like, hey. I remember instantly retorting with, look, shut the fuck up or I'll dick slap you from here. You know, it was something just like, I snapped. And suddenly two more people said, get off the fucking stage, you wanker. You know, it was just this nice New Zealand audience, and I was like, what is that? You know, every heckler line that I could think of was just like back at all these women. And I remember that finished I shut them all up. I remember they all kind of went, the next act. And then, and at the end of the night, almost, I kid you not, I was sitting at the door as they're all going out. I was so depressed. I'd never had so many people all together go, you're terrible. You're bad. You're not funny. And people were standing up doing And every single person almost who went out of the theater went, looked at me, either looked at me or actually said something. A lot of people were just like, fuck you, you know, and they walked out.
Why were you by the door then?
I don't know. I ended up on a couch by the door at the end. I was so tired. It was a long show. God, what if any training? Training. The best training is the street. There's no better training than the street. The truest teacher is your experience. So, but yeah, lots of training. I don't want to talk about it. What do you bring to the circle that no one else brings? The bumble ball. I bring the bumble ball. I remember actually having to tell someone. I was like, I brought out the bumble ball, and I was like, it's my bit. I wrote this. Don't ever do it. If I see anybody, you tell me whoever does the bumble ball bit, I'm going to kill them. What do you bring to the circle that no one else brings? I don't think I bring that much to the circle that no one, you know. I'd say I started verbal following. That would be pretty much the only thing I can really think. I think I'm the first one who really developed verbal following.
What the hell is verbal following?
Dubbing in everything behind you. Dubbing in voices, thoughts, conversations, sound effects of everything. The way I build, you know, under ideal circumstances, my love is gathering that initial crowd, just enough people that we can go, okay, and then let's watch what's going on back here, and then I dub in everything. And then if I want to, I run off and interact with it, run back to the mic, and then we wait, instead of physically following them, as I did for 6-7 years of White Face, the Met. My whole act when I first began was physically following. I did imitations and, you know, take the little stupid props out and play with the people. And I ended with a tug of war between, I mean, I have videotape from Expo 86 and
88.
No, 86, Vancouver. I have stuff from like, where I'm like, my God, that was the year that Marty Polio inspired me to get rid of Whiteface, you know. I think that's the only thing that I...
God, there's a name I hadn't heard from a while. Marty Polio, he used to hang around.
Yeah. He moved back to St. Louis. He's back. He's still working, but...
He still works.
Yeah, he still works.
But not street fame. Right?
What do you bring to the circle that no one else brings? You know, that's like a...
He answered it. I don't.
Of what ad-libbed line moment are you most... I can't remember. What ad-libbed line?
I remember one Frankie did. That was really good. Those black guys were heckling them unmercifully. Just, there were four of them. They were big and they were bruisers and... The whole audience just froze.
Right.
They were just in terror, you know. And Frankie's not a little guy, but he really doesn't come across as being very tough on stage.
Not at all.
Very. And he was on top of the unicycle, and they were just saying, "You suck, white boy," you know. This is taking him to pieces. And he just froze, and he looked at him, and they kept moving. They were just walking through the crowd. They made it all the way almost out of sight. The timing on this was really the best thing. It wasn't really the line. But till they were just out of ear range. And then loud enough so the audience could hear it, but not loud enough to where they could hear it. He goes, "Oh, yeah?" And that was it, you know. "Oh, yeah?" And it was just the perfect. And the audience was... It was just an explosion of... It was simple. It's what everybody expected. But the way he did it and the timing on it and the loudness of it really worked for his character.
It's not... The moment you're most proud... That's different, the moment you're most proud of. The ones that come to mind are like the ones that were like where danger was... I mean, I remember starting a show in front of Quincy Market at Faneuil Hall. And, you know, just getting ready and starting to do some verbal following and just getting the show going and just enough people. And I did this one guy who was walking across because it's like taking a gun and just going, you know. So and I remember him just stopping. This guy, I did his thoughts, whatever it was. And he stopped and he looked at me and he walked. He just made a beeline right up to my face. And he got this close and he just went, if these people weren't here right now, I'd beat the fucking life out of you. And he meant it. Every fucking, so deep, he was like, if they were not here, it would have just been like, wham! And then he held it right there and I was like, yeah, make a move, motherfucker.
Oh, really?
No, I mean, but I looked him down. I was like, you know, when you're in that mind of like, I'm the fucking street performer,
right,
dude.
I'm the king.
Go ahead. Yeah. You're going to take me on? Yeah, I got the mic. You know, and he like looked around for it. He like, this was like, he knew. He just, but then he left. And I was like, it's just one of those one of the few moments that.
How do you help or hinder emerging artists?
I send them to New Orleans. Are we done with the interview?
Actually, we haven't even started.
Oh,
you ready?
All right.
Is it on? Yeah.
Oh, we're still on. We've been on the whole fucking time. I know what you're doing.
No, you. Okay, describe the moment you decided to first become a busker.
Are you sure we're on?
Yeah.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by CBG Entertainment in association with Butterfly Broadcasting. To find out more about this podcast, please visit buskershalloffame.com. Now, before we sign off, we'd just like to leave you with a few last words from Lee Ross to encourage you with your career.
You're terrible. You're bad. You're not funny.
Have a great week, and please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy. Thanks for listening.